I'd like to begin our discussions of this mirror by sharing two separate yet related experiences, stories that illustrate precisely how these mirrors play out in our lives. So I mentioned earlier in the early 1990s, I'd left the corporations. I was doing some general counseling in the Bay Area while I was writing my first books. And there was another client that came in on Wednesday evenings on a regular basis. It was a woman. She had lived in abusive relationships all of her life, from her childhood to her careers, and including the marriage that she was in the moment. She and her husband had been having a very difficult time, and the situation had progressively gotten worse over time. And as she came to me that evening, I asked her the question that I asked to begin our sessions. I said, "How are you? How have things been this week?" And she shared with me the story. I'm going to share this with you. She had confronted her husband about late nights at the office and increasingly longer amounts of overtime. He refused to give her any contact information, cell phones or anything, where she could reach him. And when she asked him about specifics, he became very angry, verbally abusive, and that evening it increased until it became physically abusive. He actually knocked her to the floor. And when I saw her the following evening, she was obviously in a lot of emotional pain. She was in physical pain. They had had a tremendous fight. He walked out the door. He took some things with him, left no contact information, no way for her to reach him. And in my mind, knowing of the years of abuse that this woman had experienced and the difficulties with this man, my feeling was that she must be relieved now, because the source of all of this abuse had finally left the house. And when I asked her this question, I was surprised by the answer. I said, "Well, you must feel some sense of relief now that he's gone." And she looked at me and her eyes were red, and she'd obviously been crying all night and throughout our session. And she said to me, "No, I don't feel relief at all." She said, "I'm crushed. I am absolutely devastated by this man leaving my life." And I asked myself in that moment the question, I said, "Why? Why is this happening?" Well, it was during the same period of time. I had a routine that I would go through. On my way home from the office, I'd stop at the supermarkets and gather whatever groceries I needed for the next few evenings. Something happened one night that ties directly into this mirror. I'm going to share this story and we'll explore what this mirror is. I was walking down an aisle, a supermarket aisle, and I was the only one in the aisle until a mother and her young girl turned the aisle. The girl was in the basket with her. And they were shopping and they were reading their labels and I was reading my labels. And for just a moment, the mother walked away around a corner, and all of a sudden this young girl began to scream, this deep, powerful, primal scream, blood-curdling scream. And I jerked up from what I was reading and I look, and there was absolutely nothing happening in the aisle. I could see no reason why this young girl would be so frightened. All that had happened is that her mother had walked away out of sight for only a moment. I know we've all seen things like this happen in the past. In that moment, however, I felt differently about what I was seeing, and I asked myself the question again. I said, "Why? Why would simply finding herself alone in this aisle, surrounded by all these beautifully colored boxes and cans of things to explore, why would that frighten this young girl to the degree that I had just heard the scream?" And the answer to both of these questions is precisely the same, and it's answered with a single word, and that word is simply fear. The answer to both of these examples is because they were experiencing fear in different ways. What we know is that in our culture, we all experience fear in many different ways. What we say is that fear has many masks in our culture. When you describe your relationships to someone else or the experiences that you have in your life, if you can use words such as angry or judgmental, controlling, emotionally unavailable, physically unavailable, jealousy, hateful, critical, abusive, if those kinds of words come up in your description of your relationships with others, you are sharing in subtle and very powerful ways how the masks of fear are playing out in your life. Well, as different as the words that I just shared and many other similar words may appear on the one hand, what is so interesting is that on the other hand, all of those masks of fear, from anger and rage to hate and jealousy, they all resolve to one or a combination of only three fears that we call our core, C-O-R-E, or our root fears. fears that the ancients called universal. So what I'd like to do is share with you these three universal fears and explore how they may play out in our lives in subtle ways that perhaps we're only beginning to understand and recognize. If we do not know our universal fears, they'll play out in our lives in what are sometimes very surprising ways, unexpected ways, until the moment that we recognize what they are showing us in our relationships. So our first universal fear is a fear that many characterize as what we call separation and abandonment. This is the fear that the young girl in the grocery store supermarket was exhibiting when she screamed that deep primal scream just because she found herself alone in that basket. Almost universally, across cultural boundaries, across the lines that separate nations and beliefs, almost universally, we feel there's a sense that we are here on this earth alone. Somewhere in our ancient past, we were left here, that we were abandoned, and that we were forgotten. And this fear appears to be so deep and so primal on the one hand, on the other hand, that we will go to almost any length to mask that fear. So we will find this fear playing out in unexpected ways in our lives. You know, it's interesting. We still don't even really know who we are in our world. Even our most sacred prayer in the Western traditions, in Christian traditions, begins with a statement of separation. The Lord's Prayer, "Our Father, who art in heaven," defines us as being in one place and the creative essence that's responsible for our existence as being somewhere else. We feel that in ways now that we're only beginning to understand. If you, in your description of your relationships, can use words like devastated or crushed to describe failed or broken romances, or how you feel when jobs end before you're ready for the jobs to end, or friendships that come and go seemingly without rhyme or reason. If you can use those kinds of words, there's a good possibility that those relationships are showing you your deepest fears of the abandonment and the separation. Do you describe your broken relationships as feeling like someone has ripped a part of you away? Or in your relationships, are you always being left, or are you the ones leaving? Are you the leaver, or are you the leavee? I've known people, I've worked with engineers, who demonstrated these fears so frequently in their lives in ways that they didn't even recognize. I worked with men who left good marriages and happy families for no apparent reason other than to avoid being hurt if those relationships ended before they were ready. One of my coworkers, when I was in aerospace, I remember having lunch with him one day, and we were having this conversation. And he said, "My life is so perfect." He says, "I've got a great job, a great family, great marriage, good kids." He said, "I'm going to have to leave before something happens and I get hurt in this relationship because it's happened before." Maybe you know people who have had these experiences, or maybe this happens to you. Well, the abandonment and the separation is only the first of those three universal fears. The second is the fear that we call self-worth. Almost universally, there's a sense that we're not good enough in this world. There's a sense that we don't deserve to be in this world. And the question is, why would we feel any differently in our culture, here in the West anyway? For over 2,000 years, we've been told that somehow we are lesser beings than the angels of the heavens and the angels of other worlds, and that simply by being born into this world, we've committed an act that we will always be trying to redeem ourselves from. I'm not saying we have these conversations and we acknowledge these consciously throughout our day. These are the underlying experiences. But the ideas are reinforced, sometimes in joking terms, sometimes very serious terms, showing our inadequacy. How many times have you attempted to do something, or you shared your ideas with someone else, and the people listening have said to you, "Who do you think you are, Jesus Christ?" In a joking way, implying that you don't have the power within you to do the kinds of things that you're choosing to do. Or how will you get there? Are you going to walk on water? And these are the ways that these fears come up in our lives in seemingly innocent and unsuspecting ways. How deeply, when you hear these kinds of fears, do they actually penetrate your beliefs about yourself? Well, the second universal fear of self-worth is often expressed as issues of low self-esteem. If you find yourself creating relationships of career or relationships of friends or families or romance that never really honor the principles of your life on the one hand, and on the other hand, you stay in them time after time after time. It may be that those relationships are matching your low expectations. How many times have you heard from someone else when you ask them about their job? Do you like your job? And they say, no, you know, it's just a job. It pays the bills. It's not what I'd really like to do. That's settling. And that is an issue of low self-esteem that says this is all I'm capable of doing. This is all I'm worthy of in the moment. How many times have you heard from other people, or maybe you felt this yourself, you find yourself in a romantic relationship. And someone says, when are you going to be married? And you say, I could never marry this person. However, the relationship is good enough for now. It's someone to be with for now. It's company for now. And there's a very good possibility that those kinds of answers are saying precisely the same kind of thing to us, that we are accepting into our lives things less than our highest goals or highest aspirations, because in that moment we believe that that's all we're worthy of, that that's all that we're capable of creating. Our third universal fear, the fear of trust. Almost universally, there's a sense in this world that we've come to a world that's not safe. And why would we feel any different? Look at what we are shown every day in the images and through the media that are around us. We're inundated with signals that our world is, in fact, a scary place, that it's a dangerous place. And if we feel that, if you feel that in every moment of your life, don't be surprised if your world mirrors your fear back to you, if the mirrors promise that we will experience our suspicions, because that's what we become in our lives. Well, this mirror, the mirror of trust and surrender, may play out in ways where we find ourselves incapable of surrendering our personal selves in exchange for the experience of knowing a greater self. The need to always be in control of the world around us. If we find ourselves in relationships that reflect the expectations, we think it's a scary world, and we find people breaking into our homes and breaking into our cars and accosting us on the streets, those may be the mirrors that are meeting the expectations of precisely how we see our world, our view that our world is not safe, it's not worthy of our trust. On a personal level, these three universal fears, separation and abandonment is the first fear, self-worth is the second, and trust is the third. Those fears that play out in our personal lives as individuals all pool together as our collective lives into the whole, and there's a very good possibility then, if the principles of resonance and the mirrors work the way we believe that they work, that global events are showing us these mirrors as well. The struggle between communities and nations and the lack of peace between nations. What we learn of these fears from the mirrors of our relationships. So I'm going to ask you a question regarding your universal fears. Have you ever found yourself at a time in your life where everything is going well, you're happy, you're going through life, and all of a sudden it happens? You find yourself mysteriously, magnetically drawn to another person in a way that makes absolutely no sense for no apparent reason. You can be perfectly happy going about your day in an airport or a bus station or a mall or a classroom when it happens. Your eyes meet as you pass on the street, and for a moment, for a heartbeat, there is a feeling, possibly a familiarity, when you look into the eyes of this other person, a familiarity that says, I know you. Just for a fraction of a second, there's this glimmer of recognition, and then what happens is usually one of the two people will create some kind of distraction, almost anything, to break the energy of what has happened in that moment. They'll glance at leaves blowing across the street. They'll look at a piece of gum on the sidewalk. They'll toss their hair or adjust their glasses just to break the energy of that moment. And then the moment's gone, just like that. When those moments occur, what just happened? What was that glimmer of recognition or that sense of familiarity? For some people, these experiences are much stronger than others. I'm going to share with you an example of an engineer that I worked with when I was in the corporations. And hopefully what I'm sharing is an extreme, and also it beautifully illustrates the power of this magnetic attraction that we sometimes find for other people without understanding why. When I was in the corporations, I worked with a number of engineers, and every Friday afternoon we would go through a routine. Somebody would come around, hand us a paycheck. We would get together and carpool. We'd go cash our checks. We'd go get a bite to eat, run a couple of errands, and we'd be back in the office, hopefully within the hour if we were having a good day. Well, almost every Friday when this happened, the one engineer, the friend of mine, would have an experience many times throughout the day and even during the hour that we spent together at lunch. He would look into the eyes of another person, generally a woman, and he would feel that sense of familiarity, and not knowing any better, he believed that he was in love. And he fell in love in this way many times each day. I remember one afternoon, we went through our routine, we'd gone to the bank, we'd had lunch, we'd come back, and he was so drawn to the woman that cashed his check at the bank that he called the bank and he said, "I'd like the phone number of the teller who was the third window from the left over the lunch hour." And he called her and he asked her, he said, "Would you like to have a cup of coffee after work?" And she agreed and said yes. And when they met, because he was drawn to her, while they were meeting and having their conversation, he looked into the eyes of the woman serving them their coffee and began to have the same experience with her. And this happened to him many, many times every day. It was very confusing for him, especially because he loved his family, he loved his children, he loved his wife, and he simply didn't understand what these mirrors were showing to him. If we don't know better when we have these kinds of experiences, we may believe that we are, in fact, in love, and maybe it is. Because love, and what we call love, is what we've been conditioned to call such feelings. However, it may be something much deeper, and these experiences may be leading us, inviting us, to explore an even deeper mystery within ourselves. And once we understand this mystery, we become better people. We don't have to destroy perfectly good marriages, perfectly good families, or business relationships, because we understand what the third mystery is saying to us, the mystery of this relationship. In the early 1990s, I was teaching a weekend retreat at a bed and breakfast in Northern California area of Mount Shasta. Our group filled the entire facility, and we had the place all to ourselves, including the great room of the inn where we were staying, where we would gather for our evening discussions and watch some rare video footage of sacred sites and new discoveries throughout the world. Well, it was one evening during this program, we were watching recent release of a video exploring the possibility of life in other worlds. Suddenly the door to the inn opened and two women walked in who weren't part of our group. They were looking for a place to spend the night. The innkeeper of the bed and breakfast said to them that we were full. And although the inn was full, they appeared to be very interested in the video we were watching. We invited them to watch with us, and they stayed for another 2 hours until the lights came on. And for the first time, I could see the faces of both of these ladies for the first time. And one of them, I'm going to call her name Chris, it's not her real name. One of them, when I looked at her, I had the experience that my engineer friend was having. There was a familiarity. I was immediately drawn to her, immediately comfortable with her. And following our good nights to everyone else, neither one of us was tired. And we decided to go for a walk in the summer evening in the town of Mount Shasta, and we continued our walk into the wee hours of the morning until we said our good nights as well. And following that, I believed I would never see Chris again. Well, the next day, I'd stopped for a light while driving in the main street of town. And I looked to the curb, and I saw Chris standing there. And she came over to my window to say hello, and suddenly the lights turned, the cars behind us were anxious. I asked if she'd had lunch, she said no. I asked if she'd like to, she said yes. She jumped in, and boom, just like that, we were off having lunch together. We stopped at a restaurant on the south edge of town, where we talked through the entire lunch hour and beyond. Glancing at our watches, once again, almost 3 hours had passed while we shared our experiences and our history of marriages and family and friendships and goals in life. Chris said that she was on her way back to the East Coast after she got her Volvo station wagon repaired that day, and I was preparing to drive back to my home in northern New Mexico. After lunch, I walked her to her car, and with a hug, we kissed each other on the cheek, we said our goodbyes. I walked to my car down the street, and as I got in, something very unexpected began to happen. I found myself missing this woman tremendously. As I watched her taillights disappear down the road over the hill in front of me, this tremendous emptiness began to well up inside of me. Suddenly, waves of emotion flooded my body. I was missing a woman that I hardly knew. My eyes began to tear, and I realized something unbelievable was happening. It made very little sense to me. We'd never met before. We'd maybe spent 6 hours together. We had no plans to contact one another ever again. If I had not known better, I would have believed that I was in love. I would have gotten in my car and chased her down on the highway and pulled her over and told her so. However, I knew that love, at least in the romantic sense, was unlikely because of what the mirrors are saying to us. So what had just happened to me? I was experiencing what the Essenes call the mystery of the third mirror of relationship. It's the mirror of loss. They talk about it in the Nag Hammadi Library through the Lost Gospel of Thomas. And this particular mirror is shared as a parable. I'd like to share that parable with you now. The parable is from the great teacher Jesus sharing this information with his followers, with his disciples. And he begins by simply saying, "The kingdom of my Father is like a certain woman who was carrying a jar full of meal. While she was walking on a road, still some distance from her home, the handle of the jar broke, and the meal emptied out behind her onto the road. She did not realize it. She had not noticed the accident. When she reached her house, she set the jar down and found it empty." And this is the parable from the Lost Gospel of Thomas. What is it saying to us? This parable is designed to describe how we lose pieces of ourselves to life. As we go through life, how we give away, sometimes knowingly, sometimes unknowingly, how we have taken away from us by people with power over us, portions of ourselves that we later miss in life. In this example, our love is like the meal in the jar. As we go through life, pieces of us are lost. And this is true for both men and women. They're lost, they're given away, they're taken away by those who have power over us. Sometimes they're simply forgotten. Often these are portions of our lives that we compromise just to survive the experience of life. This is common for the youngest children in large families, for example, or women in domineering relationships. Relationships where one partner or a child will do almost anything to keep the peace in the family. They will compromise themselves in ways that they may not even be aware of, simply to have that peace. Well, after giving ourselves away for so long, what happens is we find ourselves in a time where we choose to love, we choose to share, we choose to give of ourselves to someone else. And what we find is that when we go to love, there's nothing left. Calling back the pieces of ourselves that we've lost may be one of our most compelling experiences of mastery. So the mirror that I'm sharing with you exists to different degrees for different people. To the degree that you've compromised yourself to get where you are today, in your jobs, in your careers, socially, politically, in your families and with your friendships, for every piece of you that you've lost, there remains an emptiness to be filled. Every time you give something away, you create a void within you. You can think of that void as a charge in a good way. This is a good kind of a charge. That void is looking to be filled. When we have that mysterious feeling or the attraction when we meet someone else, that is us. As we encounter someone that complements the very portions of us that have been lost, taken away, or given away. We found in another person what we lost in ourselves. It feels good when we find those things, and what we say is that we are complete. You hear people say this often, couples in relationships, one completes the other, one is the other half. And you also hear in long-term relationships, people have been married 40, 50, 60 years, when a spouse passes away, the one who survives says, "I feel as if a part of me has been lost," or "I feel if something has been ripped away." And in very accurate terms, they are describing through their voice what they're feeling on a physical and a physiological and an emotional level. Consciously or subconsciously, we're always searching for that feeling. And on a number of different levels, this is precisely what happened with my experience with Chris in Mount Shasta. but we'd only had 6 hours of conversation. I'd recognized attributes within her that I aspired to. Her beauty, her grace, her innocence, her sense of adventure, of freedom, her ability to be comfortable with strangers. All attributes that I had compromised in myself in growing up very quickly after our family had divorced and fragmented over 30 years earlier. Each of us, in our own ways, has skillfully given away portions of ourselves to a greater or a lesser degree. Portions that we believed were necessary for our survival just to get to where we are today. We'll continue with more of the mirrors of the three universal fears in our next session.